You're about to listen to a podcast from the Irish anarchist organisation Workers' Solidarity Movement. You'll find more similar podcasts on our website at www.wsm.ie.
Okay, I'm Andrew Flood from the Workers' Solidarity Movement, and I'm sitting here with Maura and Cash from Unlock NAMA. And we're going to be talking about the occupation of a building in Dublin city centre over the weekend. Lasted a few hours before it was evicted by the police. On the same day, in fact, as Occupy Oakland tried to do something similar in Oakland. And in fact, I was travelling to Belfast that day, so I missed the whole thing. But I was visiting the Occupy Bank that's up there, among other places. So let's start, I think, with talking a bit about the background situation in Ireland. And maybe, in fact, I was going to start with explaining some of the situation with the property speculation here in advance of NAMA. Because that kind of sets the context. Like a lot of places, Ireland had, during the boom, had a lot of property speculation, but in fact we had far more than most other places around the world. It was probably comparable with what was happening in Miami in the same sort of period, probably actually more intense, or what was happening in Greece. And part of that story is the story of how the euro was constructed, because you have the situation where the actual profits that were to be made in investments in Ireland, or Greece for that matter, or Portugal or Spain, was far higher than they were to be made in Germany or France. So you got a huge inflow of investments into those peripheral countries, because instead of making 2%, you were able to make 8 or 9%, which fueled the property boom. And as long as the boom kept going and the property kept going up, then you got even more money coming in. I think at the time, very few of us living here actually realised this was going on. Like, there was lots of building going on, but we didn't realise that this was all this money coming in, going into Irish banks, typically, and then going out. And that meant that when the crash arrived in Ireland and all that fell apart, we suddenly found ourselves in a situation where, you know, hundreds of billions was owed, effectively. And that was the situation where the Irish banks started to fall apart, as in many other countries, in the autumn of 2008. So the Irish government's way out of this was NAMA, which is the National Asset Management Agency, I think is what it stands for. So do you want to give us an explanation of what NAMA is?
The original purpose of NAMA was to stop the banks being nationalised. NAMA was set up to take the bad property-related loans off the banks and to replace them with these NAMA bonds, or government guaranteed securities. The idea was that the banks would have money then to stabilise them, and they could start lending again and revive the economy. NAMA failed to stabilise the banks then, and
They required further recapitalisation and nationalisation, and they haven't been lending. So basically, even in its own terms, like, it's a complete failure, really. So it's pretty shocking, I have to say. Like,
so I mean, the approximate sort of quantities of money we're talking about here was that NAMA was effectively a bad bank, so it was set up to take back the loans from the banks that looked like they were unpayable, or where a developer had a whole load of loans and some of them looked like they were unpayable. And it took in, if I'm right, I think about 90 billion in loans altogether. Mm-hmm. Now, it didn't pay full face value for those loans. They were taken in at about a 30% discount, but then you had to add 9% on an overdue interest to them. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, NAMA was in the region, the bailout was in the region for about 60 billion euro. Is about the right figure.
Big numbers.
A lot of the controversy around NAMA comes from the 15% markup they gave on the loans, because they took the loans at their estimated value at the time, which obviously had suffered a serious drop from what their original value was. But then it added this 15% markup on them, as they were expecting the economy to recover and the loans would be worth that much more. But effectively what that meant was we'd have to reinflate the economy to the bubble that it was before the crash, which is like completely unrealistic, and even if it was realistic, you wouldn't want to do it again, which is one of our aims as the group, is to challenge this logic of NAMA, this crazy logic that like got us all into the mess in the first place. And NAMA is perpetuating by the way they operate.
Yeah, I mean, part of the con when they were selling this to the population originally was this idea that the real value, or the long-term value, they called it, of the properties was higher than the loans that were coming in. And they had an abbreviation for this. And I was actually just reading today that somebody was looking into it, and this abbreviation only appeared in 2009, and just before, in fact, this whole deal was unleashed. So it was, you know, this whole concept of long-term value was invented purely to make the whole thing a lot more palatable. I mean, it's probably also, in terms of the context in Ireland, worth understanding, and again, this wouldn't be particularly unique, but the developers who were borrowing the money from the banks, and as I said, a lot of that money was international money coming into the banks, then to be lent out to the developers, but they were very closely aligned with the Fianna Fáil ruling party at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, so the other story that's happening here is a lot of corruption and a lot of basically you scratch my back, I scratch yours type situations. All that has kind of exploded out as well. So let's go on to talk about Unlock NAMA. Do you want to explain what Unlock NAMA is?
Well, Unlock NAMA is a new campaign set up basically to challenge NAMA on a number of levels, and we want to combine education, research and direct action to kind of highlight the issue, but then also become part of a movement, hopefully, that tries to, you know, first of all, kind of engage, hopefully, with NAMA as an agency, but also then to kind of highlight what it's been doing in concrete terms. For example, you know, that entails running workshops on how to identify NAMA assets, which is actually quite a difficult process and takes a lot of time and energy. And then also to actually occupy buildings to expose the actual assets that are under NAMA, which in many properties that have fallen into disrepair.
Just to say, the reason that it's so difficult to identify NAMA properties is because NAMA doesn't fall under the Freedom of Information Act, because it's not actually a state agency.
The way NAMA was set up, although it's all state money that's in it, they set up a special purpose vehicle which actually deals with the transactions, and that was set up so that 51% of it was owned by three of the banks and 49% by the state.
But those banks have been subsequently nationalised anyway, so, I mean, effectively we've got it's completely owned by the state, really.
Yeah. So because it's not under the Freedom of Information Act, the information isn't readily available. So what we have been doing is trying to find out as much as possible that we can about NAMA and trying to use that for not just our benefit, but I suppose everyone's benefit.
Yeah, so I suppose the process itself, everyone's asking us, you know, how do you find out, how do you find out? It's just kind of a complex series of cross-referencing various sources, and it is extremely difficult to be 100% sure on anything that we actually find, which is kind of part of the problem, and it does make it extremely difficult to actually be able to identify buildings, you know, and then to actually be able to occupy them. Also, a lot of buildings are only half used or half empty, so there's a lot of different conditions which they're in. NAMA also own land, so, you know, there's a much wider kind of context operating there.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got the typical problem with any discussion around the financial end of the international crisis and banking. It actually gets really complicated fast that it was quite hard to know what on earth they're talking about. And the NAMA situation, you've the added difficulty that they kept as much of it secret as they can. Like, so it's not really known which buildings are in and out of NAMA. It's, you know, it's not that well known which developers, how much money, you know, everything they've kind of tried to bury, and people have been working to try and find it out, and they've been trying to stop people finding it out.
Yeah, and not only do they keep it secret, but the information they do release is completely misleading. For example, the properties they release on their enforcement action list, the properties that they've actually taken over or repossessed, you could say, they give the addresses, the area that the property's in. They don't give it, like, the street number. But a lot of the properties are actually labelled completely wrongly. They'd be labelled as Dublin 2 when they're actually in Dublin 1, or they'd be labelled as a warehouse when they're actually an office building. So not only does that make it difficult for us, but if NAMA was to actually work as it said it was going to work for any potential buyers who were interested in buying the property, it would make it difficult for them too.
Yeah.
It's probably also worth pointing out that, in fact, we're not just talking about properties in Ireland. Some, as I understand it, NAM actually is covering loans on properties rather than properties themselves, but some of those properties are in London, for instance, as well, because there was a lot of Irish speculative investment was going there as well.
There's many properties in Northern Ireland, England, Scotland, Wales, and across Europe. There's some, I believe, in New York as well.
Yeah, there is some in the States, definitely. I mean, not a significant amount. Most of it is in Dublin and the Republic, to be honest. But yeah, there is a substantial amount in London. I think $6 billion is in London. So yeah, it's quite big. But I think it makes sense for our campaign. We're kind of focusing at the moment on the area that we're kind of involved in, because I think, you know, it is so all-encompassing. It can be quite daunting if you try to undertake research anywhere and everywhere, which is why we're kind of focusing on Dublin City kind of at the moment.
Okay, so I mean, that's basically what Unlock Now is about. Where did it come from? Where did the idea for the setting up the group come from?
I suppose just over a series of conversations over the last few months, really. And then, well, we started meeting about 2 months back, really, and then the structure of the group kept changing, and our aims, you know, only recently kind of became more structured. But myself and Kat were involved previously in a failed campaign to get another NAMA building. It's called the City Arts Building. It's quite famous as a kind of community centre and art space. That subsequently burned down a few months ago, and that kind of ended our campaign. But I suppose where this is different than, for me anyway, I was interested in challenging NAMA in a broader context, which wouldn't mean just having the goal to occupy one building and take that back, but it would be more about a process of, you know, challenging NAMA through different levels, of which occupation is incredibly important, but it's just one element to it.
Okay, so that's the kind of specifics of the background of it. Let's talk about Saturday a bit. So Saturday there was the occupation of the building on Great Strand Street. How did that come about?
Well, basically, so through our research, as Kat mentioned, one of the properties labelled wrongly was this property on Great Strand Street, but it was one that we kind of came across in our research and thought, this is a usable building, we could do something with this, and we arranged a series of viewings, legitimate viewings, to kind of just check out the building. And what we found was it was in a state of disrepair. It's three stories, and there's basically a hole going all the way through where the water drips, and then there's also mould everywhere, and there's dead pigeons and all sorts of things. But quite clearly it had been just left to ruin, and this building had been empty for about 6 years. So basically we thought it was a really good example of how, you know, NAMA are not managing their assets, or this asset, very well. So, you know, it's a very good place to start in terms of a campaign launch, because you know, we're opening it up, we're exposing something that's, you know, trying to be kept hidden. So it worked very well for propaganda purposes to take pictures of this building, you know, and to say, well, this is what they're doing. It also kind of works very well on a more direct level between different people, you know, like because the NAMA is so abstract that if you actually have a way to kind of visualize it, to actually be in the building, to see it, it kind of changes the way you think about NAMA, I think, which is why it's really important to have a concrete building. And that just happened to be the easiest one. It's also in the city centre. It was quite easy to direct people towards it. People kind of know the area, so it's very useful.
So basically, people got into the building, it was tidied up and set up for set public events on Saturday. Now that's interesting in itself, because as I mentioned at the beginning, I was up in Belfast and they occupied an old bank building in Belfast about 3 weeks ago now.
Yeah.
But the problem, one of the problems they have with that occupation is their police tried to get in initially and they barricaded themselves inside. But it kind of means they can't open it up to the public and let people in. So it's, you know, some of the people who were involved in occupy Belfast camp are basically living there. Of course, you know, that's the limits of it. They will need kind of a bit of a discussion as to, you know, could they risk opening it up? Would that be a better use?
Mm.
So, I mean, you obviously took the decision to do something quite different, which was to actually open it up and bring people in.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain the logic of doing things that way?
Yeah. Basically, I think it was really important for us in our discussions that, you know, what we do with NAMA, we want to open it to the public, basically to reinforce the logic that these are public buildings, they belong to us. We are legitimate in doing this action. We don't have to answer to NAMA. You know, these, if we walk in and say, this is our building, then we must act in such a way. So I think if we'd have to, you know, barricade it up for our event, that kind of would be a failure. You know, it wouldn't communicate the message that we want. On the day itself, it was brilliant. You know, there was quite a number of passers-by walking in. You know, there were kids. It just had a totally normal kind of atmosphere about it, even though, you know, it was a very strange thing to do. And I think that is really important, you know, to just assert, you know, our own ownership of these buildings. Obviously, the situation in Belfast is completely different. But I suppose another criticism or something people always question in terms of the launch was like, oh, you've got this giant building, you know, why only do a day-long event? Why not keep it? And, you know, I could see when we walked in, and especially after cleaning it up, you had a sense of attachment, you know, and you're kind of like, oh, we could keep it. But essentially, you know, it wasn't in a very good condition. So in a way, that was even better. You know, it's like, well, we can't even use this building. That's how bad it is. But definitely the public element of it was very important.
Also, like, the building was in bad condition. It would have taken a lot of work to do it up. Like, we, you know, potentially could have held onto it and could have done it up, and maybe it could have been something really great, but that would have taken all the energy of the campaign, that would have taken all the energy of people involved to do just that kind of one thing with the one building, whereas we're more interested in making it, like, a lot more widespread, with, like, getting the information out there to as many people as possible, to do what they want with these buildings, to get involved and to really challenge what's going on in this country, as opposed to just, like, using all your energy to cling on to one building.
Yeah, I think in our meetings we did discuss kind of that the impact that might have psychologically on someone, you know, like when you become attached to a specific building, that can be really great. But I think for a campaign that's trying to raise awareness about NAMA, you know, it could quite easily just distract from the work that we actually set out to do. And certainly there are so many NAMA assets, you know, just it wouldn't even make sense to just kind of keep pointing towards one of them.
Okay, so you opened up and you had three people lined up to speak at the event. So tell us who they were and why you decided to ask each of them.
Yeah, so we had first Conor McCabe. He's quite well known. He's been giving a lot of talks around kind of the activist scene in Dublin and Ireland for a number of years. He wrote a really good book called Sins of the Father as well. He was talking on NAMA and property speculation in general, so he gave a really nice kind of in-depth talk about that. Then we had lined up Andy Story and Michael Taft. They were going to talk about another campaign that's just been launched called the Anglo Not Our Debt campaign. It was just basically kind of set up very recently as well in relation to the bonds being paid out through Anglo-Irish Bank. So it's kind of, that's a kind of a parallel campaign, but links in very much with what we're doing because, you know, it's all about debt essentially. So they were due to speak. And then the third workshop was going to be Unlock NAMA ourselves, giving a workshop on how we actually identify the NAMA assets. So, you know, I'd have a projector and kind of go through the process itself so everyone would know, which is actually a really important part of our campaign as well, is that we spread the knowledge and spread the skills to actually do this stuff.
Yeah, in fact, the Anglo Debt campaign you mentioned, I got to the second half of the launch meeting last week, and I mean, what they basically decided to do is focus in on the debt that arose from just one of the banks, which is Anglo-Irish Bank. And that was a particularly, I mean, it was basically a bank that purely existed for the developers. Mm. You know, it had very few customers. A lot of the ones it did have were borrowing sums that were like, you know, 500 million, like 10 people or something, owned 500 million to it. So, you know, it was basically purely a vehicle for investors, you know, property speculators. It had no meaning to anybody else. It wasn't like a high street bank that you'd walk in on off the street. But it also, when it collapsed, it left some of the biggest debts because it had been doing the dodgiest deals. And So that's why they focused on that particular one. The argument for cancelling that is the strongest thing. But the thing I remember from the meeting was they gave the figure that, in fact, the amount of debt from Anglo alone is €26,000 for every single man, woman and child in the country. So basically, if you're a four-year-old kid, your share of that debt is €26,000.
That's crazy.
And why the government, like, the Irish government keeps using this rhetoric of we all partied, you know, it's everybody's fault. Well, Anglo is the really clear example where it really isn't everybody's fault. This wasn't a bank that was lending money to people so they could buy a house.
Yeah.
It purely lent to property speculators, you know, who were building 1,000 houses or 500 apartments or whatever else. So, you know, on that level, it seems a really clear example. That's why they focused on that in particular.
Yeah, it's a shame it didn't happen.
So let's move on to the not happening.
Yeah.
Essentially, what happened was after the first meeting, I think I wasn't there, so you'll need to describe this bit, but sometime after that, the police arrived. So.
Yeah, so what happened was basically Conor McCabe gave his talk, he was the first one to speak, and then around 1 o'clock, we just went for our break before the next speakers, and a private security firm kind of pulled up and started making a lot of inquiries about the building. I'm not exactly sure what happened in that time.
He pulled up and just in his van outside, and he was there just watching us for a while. I think he was more scared of us than we were of him, making frantic phone calls. And eventually, a representative of the estate agent turned up. This is the estate agent that would be hired by the receiver, who's hired by NAMA to look after selling the property, and then the guards were called. The guards turned up in quite large numbers.
Yeah, surprisingly.
And we, inside at this stage, obviously anyone with small children or anything vacated the building, and there was a group of about 50 of us left inside.
So yeah, I mean, basically we were asked to leave, and you know, they said that they denied the fact that they told us we were wrong. They said this building isn't in NAMA actually, and you all have to leave. You're all breaking the law. So that, you know, that kind of everybody reacted slightly differently to that. But we did hold a series of emergency assemblies to make a decision, and we got someone to negotiate with the guards. We negotiated time, and then eventually we had legal people. Our legal people came.
Our solicitors.
Yeah, our solicitors. So that was helpful. But then essentially the collective decision was to leave the building as asked. Basically, I think
we bargained for an hour so that we could bring on our stuff. We had quite a lot of equipment and chairs and
nice stuff that we spent a lot of time working on that we didn't want to lose. And the banner, of course, the banner. Nice big banner outside. But yeah, so essentially we decided that as a campaign launch, we made our point. And then also this process itself, you know, is very valuable and says a lot about, you know, how the state responds when we take this action and, you know, how they relate to our argument.
I think the most inspiring thing at that time, though, was because we were inside deciding what to do once the police showed up for so long and we had bargained for that error. By the time we were coming outside, a large crowd had gathered outside, and as every person exited the building, there was massive tears and everything. So we knew the support was there, that the media seemed to be even on our side for once. And the only people that didn't want us there was the receiver and NAMA themselves, it seemed, like the guards weren't even too unfriendly.
Yeah, that's true. But it was interesting because kind of through the negotiations, it did prove that we were right about the receiver and how that was connected to NAMA. So, I mean, a lot of people there saw in front of their eyes, you know, the process of negotiation, which is essentially, you know, it exposed how NAMA operate and how they relate to the different elements at play in their organisation. So it really did expose all the inner workings of the agency in the context, obviously, of people trying to take over the building. So I would view the launch as a success in that, you know, it generated that process, and then also got a lot of interest and a lot of support. That, you know, I mean, of course, if we had a successful day and we just left at 6 o'clock, it would have been completely different, and not bad either. But I think it's interesting to see that when the police arrived, the difference in how the day went. But I think it was a success. I think what we decided to leave, some people did feel, in fairness, that they should stay and make a political point that, you know, this is our building and it belongs to us and go through that kind of lengthy procedure. But I think most people felt that it, for the launch, you know, it's just the beginning. It maybe that we're not ready to kind of go there yet. Maybe it's too extreme. We're just kind of finding our feet now. So I think we're trying to. This project, I think, is kind of designed to work over a longer period of time and in a more serious kind of way. So.
Yeah, I mean, from effectively watching it from the outside, driving down the train after it was all over, one of the obvious benefits to the fact that rather than, say, doing a public meeting at a hotel, you went with the occupation, was that there was actually a very considerable amount of media coverage coming out of it. I mean, do you want to talk about the sort of coverage that happened? Do you think it's mostly been good? Or?
I think largely it's been good. Yeah, some really surprising things coming out of it, like this morning two people involved ended up on a morning chat show talking to two minor celebrities.
This is on the television.
Yeah. Which was bizarre, to say the least. There's been a few odd articles and a bit of misreporting and kind of speculating about who we are and what we're doing, but other than that I think it's been mostly positive. And surprisingly, it's been surprising to see the positivity, and a lot of people seem to be on our side and realise that, you know, a lot of things we're saying make complete sense and are worth getting angry about and are worth getting involved in. And
it is interesting to be involved in a campaign around a particular issue that has such widespread criticism. Like, so many different types of people, even very right-wing conservative people, would be critical of NAMA, you know, because it doesn't work on any level. So even in terms of the media, I mean, the only kind of hostile questions you would get, which we have gotten a number of times, is around the legality of you know, getting into a building and you know, the fact that that's wrong and somebody does own that building and it can't just be open for everyone and that kind of stuff. That's the only kind of annoying questions. I mean, other than that, people have very rarely actually asked, you know, isn't NAMA a good thing? People don't really, the media don't go with that angle, surprisingly, which makes it very easy.
I don't think one person has asked, isn't NAMA a good thing?
No, I don't think so.
I think
so
that says a lot.
Yeah, and that's mainstream media as well.
So, well, I mean, just as the crisis isn't just an Irish thing, it's international, this sort of, you know, the occupation of buildings is also happening internationally as well. I mean, I mentioned the attempted Oakland occupation on Saturday, which ended somewhat differently. I think they had about 400 people arrested. Many of them are apparently still in jail. And there's some quite nasty reports coming out of the jails there about the way people are being treated. There's also the occupation of, what was it called, the Bank of Ideas in London,
yes,
which...
Yeah.
Got evicted late last week, wasn't it?
Yeah,
as well?
I think around
the same time period. To what extent are you aware of those things happening and drawing any lessons from them?
Well, I think the wider context, you know, it's actually been there longer as well. I think in Ireland, particularly in the last decade or so, there's been very little activity, and we're so used to looking to other countries, you know, in Europe and abroad, and just, you know, being so amazed and excited by what's going on there, and kind of look at Ireland and think, why isn't anything happening here? So I suppose there's just so much, especially in the last few months, there's been so much to catch up on that, you know, I certainly find it's very difficult to keep up with all the ins and outs of everything, which is a good thing, you know. It's a really, really good thing. It's a sign of a real movement, I think, internationally. But also, another thing to mention is the Cork took an AMA building around Christmas time, and they 2 days ago or 3 days ago have just been evicted as well. So that was interesting news, you know, just after our thing on Saturday. So even close to home, this kind of stuff is happening already.
Yeah, obviously what we're doing links in globally, but I suppose picking something such as NAMA to kind of focus on is like the Irish version of, say, things that are happening in other countries. It's the battle here in Ireland. And especially, as you said earlier, it's quite a complex beast, so yeah. I've had my head buried in so much research on NAMA that I think I'm losing track of the rest of the world.
Yeah. Well, but in that, actually, it's a very important point for our campaign, and it's something we have talked about. There's actually a lot of empty property in this country that isn't owned by NAMA and doesn't have anything to do with it. That, you know, it's just as wrong that that property is sitting there empty, you know, than NAMA. And just like other countries, the logic would be, oh, occupy buildings, occupy an empty bank. A lot of people don't make a distinction between, you know, NAMA building and a non-NAMA building. But I suppose, you know, for us to have any kind of real meaningful kind of change, or at least to kind of challenge NAMA itself, you have to obviously only focus on empty NAMA properties. And I do find it quite frustrating because there's a lot of, you know, empty stuff out there that isn't under NAMA, and you'd just be like, wow, imagine if we took that over. But I just think that's for another group of people, that's for another campaign, and I think it's crucially important that we focus on NAMA and don't kind of
get ranchered.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw an estimate last week, which was from one of the research institutes in Maynooth University, because part of the thing is nobody really knows, there isn't really a good register of buildings, and in fact, well, it's part of the story of the corruption, but some Irish counties don't seem to have kept account of what was built in the Celtic time at all, particularly where the most ones happened in, and where they're in the most ludicrous locations. But anyway, their estimate was that there were, I think, 300,000 empty housing units in the country, which is an incredible amount.
I think that researcher in Maynooth, Rob Kitchen, said that. Yeah, I think that's the figure he came up with.
Yeah, it is shocking, and you know, I do get frustrated sometimes because I hear so many people, and even activists, like people actually organized, involved and stuff, saying, you know, oh, have to house the homeless. Look, there's all these empty buildings. And there have been, I think, a number of campaigns kind of set up to try and do stuff about that. And even NAMA themselves have said they'd give over a certain amount for social housing. But it's a head wrecker. I mean, it's really hard to kind of organize something around that. You know, it's a lot of work. It takes a lot of qualified, committed, serious people. It's just a giant task that I couldn't even think of, you know, starting right now myself. So, I mean, it's quite baffling, you know, just the numbers involved.
I suppose that's why it's interesting, and where the potential is for this campaign to go, is that at the moment we're all based in Dublin and we're focusing mostly on Dublin, which is largely commercial property and such, whereas once you leave Dublin, it starts becoming either land or residential, and there's a whole other area of struggle that could be really interesting. And if the campaign does grow, hopefully that will be a whole other element to it, and we can go in that direction. But right now we need to focus on what we can do and do what we can do first.
Yeah, exactly. I think we're thinking of it in terms of small victories that we can genuinely win, and just then also crucially consistency, that, you know, we maintain a level of research and activity at all times to run a successful campaign. I think otherwise, if you build up towards a giant, you know, event, it just I don't think that would work, you know. I don't think that would work for what we're trying to do, and certainly I think it would be quite counterproductive, kind of like what we were talking about earlier. I suppose I just foresee as well, like in relation to, say, the countryside, it has a totally different dynamic. I mean, even just in my head, thinking how to organise people, you know, around getting land and empty houses, it's just so much more difficult. The city has a lot of advantages in that as well.
Although there has been a very interesting example of a man in Mullingar who moved into an empty house in a ghost estate, so a empty housing estate in Mullingar, and he did the house up. He just wanted to live there. He was homeless and he just moved into the house. He did it up, he made it nice for himself, and then when he eventually ended up in court over it, the judge ruled that he could stay there because, you know, sure, he was trespassing, but he wasn't with intent to commit any kind of crime, because the evidence was there that he was making the most of the property. So that was a mini victory in terms of battling or encouraging them to make use of these vacant housing
True. Yeah, it's interesting because, like, there's a lot of... I would imagine in this case there's a lot of pressure from the public, you know, like NAMA can't just do what they want, you know, if they... You know, this... I mean, this person, I'd say, people really took pity on him, or, you know, genuinely supported his reasons for doing it. Like, ordinary people can connect to those kind of struggles, and I think that's another way that you can win against NAMA, you know, if you do win the hearts and minds of people who quite clearly, you know, already most people would think it's wrong, or it just doesn't make any sense. It really, I mean, and that's we have very little difficulty convincing people, which is great, you know. Like, I think a lot of activist kind of projects, that's a much bigger problem, especially if you're coming from a kind of strong left-wing perspective, it could be a lot more difficult. So at least on this one, you can really attract a lot more attention to it from people that you wouldn't normally engage with.
So to flip it back to that big broad picture again, I love those. I mean, I'm reading Paul Mason's Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere at the moment, and it's very interesting because it's kind of put the history of since the crisis into a kind of perspective. Mm. And I mean, it struck me in Ireland as it was happening here, but also it becomes obvious internationally as well, that there's 30 months basically from when the crisis hits in the autumn of 2008. But there's not that much resistance to it. I mean, yes, there's, you know, there's rioting in Greece, there's some strikes there. We have our own public sector strike here. You know, things do happen, but it's quite small scale. But it's really 2011 that things start to take off. And, you know, initially in the context of the rebellion in Tunisia, quickly followed by the one in Egypt, quickly followed by Libya. You know,
then Spain.
And then, yeah, the Spanish movements, you know, the May 15th movement, they had the camps that were set up there, and then the Occupy movement running through. I mean, do you have that sense of things developing quite fast as well? Not just here, but...
Yeah, I certainly would anyway. I think from being in the previous campaign, which, you know, started over a year ago now, I think... it felt totally different. You know, we were a group of people and we, you know, NAMA, we wanted to challenge NAMA, we wanted to occupy a building. But, you know, somewhere in the back of my mind, certainly I just felt like, oh, this just isn't going to happen. I don't know why, I couldn't put my finger on it. But then, like you say, all of these movements kind of happened. And especially, I suppose, with the Occupy movement taking off in Ireland, I suppose very much influenced by Wall Street. I think that kind of... that way of talking about things and organising. I suppose, you know, Ireland and New York have quite a strong connection anyway, so that just took off really big here in Ireland. Definitely, you know, there is some kind of sense of connection or relevance there, or wider context. But I suppose also, you know, looking at the bigger picture, I don't know. It is quite surprising how slowly it took people to react. But I think time, thinking about things in the long term, is very crucial now. I think we're all facing years and years and years of austerity. Things are going to get really tough. You know, I think we have to start orientating ourselves towards a long term plan of how to get out of this.
Definitely. And NAMA itself isn't due to wind up until 2020, so we have at least another 7 years.
Yeah.
Okay, so, well, let's end on the kind of, and you've already touched on some of this, you know, where you see things going next in terms of this local situation and on what manner.
Well, the support is great at the moment, so we really want to harness that and move on to the next stage, which is we've got all the information now, but we don't have all the information. We have loads of information now that we want to get out to as many people as possible so that they can get involved in the campaign. Because there is a certain level of knowledge that is not entirely necessary, but helpful to know if you want to get involved in the campaign. So the kind of basics of what NAMA is, why it's bad, and how to... Well, the major one is how to find out whether or not a property is a NAMA property, how to find out... what NAMA properties are in your area, what's the interest, what they could be used for. So if we need community centres or social centres, or if you need a place to house a bike workshop project, or to rehouse. Recently a theatre group got kicked out of a NAMA building because they weren't generating enough rent for it. So to rehouse that kind of group, or if there's groups like that...
Yeah, definitely. I think there's just, you know, there are different ways to engage with the project, which is great. You know, it's quite diverse. I mean, you know, hopefully everyone who's getting involved in any capacity would be interested and feel it's important to know how NAM operates, you know, to at least a small extent, like Kat said. But then, you know, there are so many different ways of getting involved. You know, well, like we do have a core group at the moment, about 12 people. We're hoping to branch out and, you know, maybe kind of specialise in different areas or whatever. So, certainly the point is expansion, you know, definitely just to expand the group itself and, you know, to spread, do more education workshops, do more public talks and do more direct actions.
So if people want to follow developments online, want to tell us about your Facebook?
We have our website, unlocknama.org, and then we also have Twitter and Facebook. It's just unlocknama.
If you search on either Facebook or Twitter for unlocknama, you'll find those respective feeds, and the stuff is going out fairly regularly on them. And then the website again is unlocknama.org. Right?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay,
that's it.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
Okay,
thanks,
Andrew.
That audio interview was a podcast from the Workers' Solidarity Movement. You'll find more audio on our website at www.wsm.ie. Thanks for listening.